It is a center for higher learning.
It is a place with centuries of secrets in its shadowed halls.
This is where you have come to learn the mysteries of the cosmos.
Welcome to the Miskatonic University Podcast.
They'll teach you.
Hello and welcome to the Miskatonic University Podcast, episode 141. This is the podcast dedicated to Call of Cthulhu and other horror and Lovecraft-related role-playing games. I'm Keeper Dan.
I'm Keeper John, and in this episode, we catch up with Chris Spivey of Darker Hue Studios.
I'm Keeper Murph. Yeah, we got to talk with him about Harlem Unbound and his upcoming projects.
And I'm Keeper Chad, and then we got a little weird and got to riff on how to pull mythos ideas from TV shows.
And Chad's obsession with Dallas.
No, shut your mouth. Shut your tiny little blueberry hole.
Let's head into the campus crier.
Miskatonic University Campus Crier.
The Campus Crier's Miskatonic U student paper. We're just going to go through mythos-related news and feedback for the show. This episode is recorded on March 15th, 2018.
81 years.
Yeah.
Lovecraft has passed.
Yeah. It's the Lovecraft's death day and the Ides of March.
That's right. Where you don't just celebrate stabbing, you celebrate stabbing as a group.
Yeah.
Not just murder, but group murder.
It's a bonding experience.
Golden Geek Awards has announced the new stuff for 2017. And Tales from the Loop got Best RPG. It also got runner-up for Best Artwork and Presentation. That's the most notable horror-adjacent winner on the list this year. Check out the rest of the winners over at the RPG Geek website, and we have a link in the thingy.
As you guys know, one of my other passions is the Dungeon Crawl Classics role-playing game. And one aspect of that game that has grown and kind of taken a life on its own are fan-produced zines. Well, there is a brand new zine available on DriveThruRPG called Crawlthulu. This zine is written and produced by John Potts. And it's actually pretty damn cool. I've already downloaded it. It introduces a sanity mechanic and Dungeon Crawl Classic stats for 1920s firearms. It also includes an adventure titled The Horrible Day at Dunwich Fair. So it's all pretty cool for this zine. And as we are recording this, you can get it for only $3 on DriveThruRPG. Its normal cover price is $8.
Nice.
Huh.
And Chaosium has announced winners of the Cult of Chaos Scenario Writing Contest. There are 7 of them, and we're not going to go through all of them, but we have 2 notable winners from the MU Nation circles, including David Larkins, who we've talked to online, and for Wailing Woman, that is a Down Darker Trails scenario, and Shannon Mack for The Search for Brian Boru. That's a Cthulhu Dark Ages scenario. Congratulations, Shannon and David, and to all the winners.
Yeah, we should have them on the show and talk to them further about it.
Sounds good.
And there's a Kickstarter in progress for a horror detective comic based on the works of H.P. Lovecraft. And the blurb for it reads, Private Investigator Hank Hellcraft must contend with a troubled family past while becoming engulfed in mysteries that reveal indescribable horrors hidden just beneath the surface. And I have to say that Hank Hellcraft doesn't give me the most confidence.
Right. It's in the classifieds. Huh. Yeah.
I actually read this today. It's good. It's fun. And it's okay. It's not like overly grotesque at all either. You know, so I wouldn't be upset to hand this. I would be pleasantly happy to give this to my oldest daughter and tell her to read that to try and get her into it.
That's cool. Okay.
I really like the artwork. It's a heavy line, yeah, heavy lines, yeah. And I am a fan of heavy lines.
I think their Kickstarter is supposed to finish out the series and raise money to put it into a collection.
Oh, that is in progress, and we didn't talk about it's at the time of recording, it's 20 days to go, and that's going to be a thin margin by the time this drops. So check it out.
It's now not quite at its $3,800 goal. It's, I don't know, what, a third of that maybe? And, yes, so this wraps up on April 5th. And so check it out.
Yeah.
Adam Crossingham posted some updates about 60 Stone projects on YSDC. The 60 Stone website is currently down, so after some speculation about the fate of the company, Adam has posted some updates to those forums. First off, he says that the top priority is getting the Massive Narlathot Companion Kickstarter finished. He's also still converting Colonial Mythos Country to 7th edition, and the next two Investigator Weapons books have gone back to Hans for 7th edition integration. There are a lot of corrections to make on the Cthulhu by Arc-like layout files, and he hasn't decided whether to convert it to 7th edition or to Delta Green, which is interesting. And then other books will basically be done when they get done. And there's more details that you can find on the forums over at Yogg-Sothoth, and we have a link to that in the show notes.
Golden Goblin Press is holding a spring cleaning sale. It's kind of cool. You can get 20% off all physical items and 30% off orders that are over $60 on physical items. That includes the RPGs and fiction material, and the sale runs until April 15th. The discount code will be in the show notes, so you can get that there.
Sounds good. So a Brazilian-Portuguese version of Call of Cthulhu successfully kickstarted back on February 2nd. And it made about $71,000, which is 231,000 Brazilian real, for those of you who want to convert. And so, behold to everyone, gonna have to pronounce this in Portuguese. That wasn't thought through when I put my name on this. I think it's...
Chamado de Cthulhu.
Chamado de Cthulhu, yeah, something like that. It's pretty cool when a new version of the Call of Cthulhu rules reaches other languages, so worth a mention.
And Chaosium has released Sandy Peterson's Abominations. This is the book that's been talked about for a long while now that is basically a lot of his convention scenarios that have been dropped into a book and kind of rewritten by Mike and brought into full-on publication status.
It looks really cool.
Can't wait to get my hands on that. And last up, a big thank you to Max, who is actually editing this episode. So thank you very much, Max.
Thank you, Max.
We're sorry.
Thank you, man.
May Narlathotep help you.
You'll need some sort of otherworldly power in order to get through this one.
Mm-hmm.
Study the work of your school librarian, and perhaps you can secure permission to assist.
Hey, and we wanted to salute MUP's resident librarian, Graham, and thank him for keeping the card catalog fully stocked. He recently sent in links to an amazing list of naval ships that are listed as fictional, though many are historical ships with fictional names. This is really an amazing list of vessels broken down by nation and year, and we have a full list of links in the show notes. But trust me, this is an amazing resource that someone took a lot of time and effort to put together. So go check it out.
Thanks, Graham.
Thank you much. We are going to be kind of going through some of the lost feedback, as it were. And so we're taking a look at some of those emails that were sitting in there that we had missed in times past, and we just wanted to touch base with some of this stuff. We had over the last year, we're going to roll some dice and pick one out. This one starts off with, "Hi, Keepers. I've been running Call of Cthulhu again after a year and a half off. My first few games have been for players new to Call of Cthulhu with other RPG experience. As they got more comfortable with the system, they began to make sanity rolls all on their own when they encountered anything weird. It was a bit weird to me, but not really annoying."
Yeah, that's actually always kind of cool. I like that.
Agreed.
Yeah. This is until they reach the final portion of the scenario, called Amidst the Ancient Trees, and they had very little sand left. I like that. Two of the three players went insane before, avoiding spoilers, and the end was revealed. The other one ran away, so I didn't get to finish the scenario, really.
I've also been listening to a lot of live plays where players are voluntarily losing sand without rolls. I was just wondering your thoughts on player-initiated sand loss and rolls.
And he wraps up by saying, thanks for the great show. Go Pods. That's by Keeper Kent.
Thank you, Kent.
Good question, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, like I alluded to, I like it when the players realize that, oh, this is messed up. I'm going to roll sand. I actually haven't heard anyone on in live plays or anything simply say, oh, I'm going to lose without rolling, is what the way I'm reading it here. I mean, certainly, if you roll for your sand, you don't know how much to lose. I mean, you have to engage with the keeper, right, and find out. Or are these people not only rolling sand, but going, oh, that seems like a D6 to me. I mean, what are they doing? You'd have to engage with the keeper and say, I failed my sand roll. What happens?
I imagine that's how it goes, is they roll against their own sand and then they say what happens.
Yeah.
I love this. I think it's a symptom of a great game. It means that your players are feeling complicit in the horror, which I think is a goal for me. It's a personal goal. And I personally like to ask players about their characters, do you think this would disturb your character, at least in the early stages, so that gets them thinking of, like, oh, I guess it would, and try to imagine what the situation would be like. So if they're doing it on their own, I say it's awesome.
Yeah, it's also a decent sign of fairly good role players in general, whenever they're willing to take that on themselves to do it without the keeper initiating it. Because a lot of times these players will realize what their character is more than the keeper will, if you know what I mean. So it's like, oh, well, my librarian just saw like 5 dead bodies and the keeper hasn't asked me for a sand check, but I'm going to go ahead and prompt him for it because I know I should have one.
Right.
So, I mean, it's also assigned to a pretty good group you got going as well.
Yeah. I love the idea that they're invested in it. They just feel that, yep, this is weird. I don't think he's going to respond well to this. And so they roll it. And I could even see just saying, on those voluntary rolls, if they want to just deduct a single point for themselves because they're not being called for by the keeper, I'd be okay with that.
Yeah, and I also like the inverse a little bit. I've had it happen for me a couple of games where I've described something pretty horrific, but usually still what we would consider in the realm of realistic, right? This is, it might be a horror that is something that you could actually see in real life. And so then I've had players go, oh, wow, I should probably roll sand or can I roll sand or something to that effect? And I'll pause and I'll say, it's not weird enough yet. No, you don't have to roll yet. And that usually will kind of freak them out a little bit because they're going, oh, this isn't bad enough for sand. What is going to break me and cause me to roll sand? And then that's when the other shoe drops,
Yeah. Yeah, there are situations where you might want to control it. I can imagine it getting silly where people, I'm a librarian and I just saw an overdue book, so I'm going to roll sand.
You could
use it the wrong way, I think, for the tone. So I am super happy to say that the 3 listeners have graciously submitted segments for us to enjoy this episode. So Woo-hoo! Sit back and we get to be listen to like a little mini podcast. thanks so much to each of you for your hard work and for the richness that you're bringing to the show. And to the rest of you, if you still have ideas for segments simmering, please, it's not too late to send us a pitch at mup.feedback@gmail.com.
Yep. And this isn't something that's required to every episode. If you want to come up with an idea that's like every 2 or 3 episodes you send something in, that's
absolutely
fine.
Or just a one-off.
Yep.
Hey.
Yeah. Or just a one-off is just dandy, too.
Just try it out. We'll put these in rotation. And so first up, I'm really super happy to announce that the 2nd episode of Glimpses into the Empire is ready to go. So let's go back to Ancient Rome for episode 2, Omens.
Salve, citizens. I am Ascarius Tabularis, and this is Glimpses into the Empire. Today is the 15th day of Martius, or as you barbarians might know it, the Ides of March, This day reminds us not to discount omens. But what are omens? Why should you be concerned with them? And what exactly should you be looking for? Well, the answer begins with where all things begin, with the gods. The gods, and I don't care which gods you do or don't believe in, the gods know everything. They know what's in store for us before it happens. Sometimes, if they're in a generous mood, they'll warn us that some misfortune is due to befall us in the immediate future. But they won't stop it from happening or keep us from making the wrong choices. It's like a parent allowing a willful child to touch a candle flame after they've told them multiple times not to do it. The gods know better than anyone that some people only learn once they get burned. Omens are divine warnings. Signs from the gods that something, sometimes good, but most often bad, is going to happen to us and that we need to be careful, rethink a course of action, or just stay in bed. Who says the gods aren't generous? But the gods don't make things easy for us. Most omens are common things that happen every day, and if we aren't mindful, we'll miss them. An omen can be something as simple as someone sneezing and interrupting your conversation, or spilling salt or wine, having a nightmare, or losing a personal belonging. Dripping while crossing a doorway is a really bad one, which is why we Romans carry our new brides across the threshold when she first enters our homes. I think you guys do that too. You got that from us. Most of the time, we don't realize something's an ill omen until it's far too late and we're neck-deep in disaster. Who says the gods aren't sadistic? For example, you come across some clams at a really low price in the market. Do you buy them? Maybe the seller had an abundance of clams that morning and needs to move stock. Or maybe the clams are days old and they're on the verge of turning. So you think for a moment. Then you suddenly remember that on the way to the market, you broke a strap on your sandals. This, you decide, is an ill omen, a warning from the gods that bad things are in store for you today. So you pass on the questionable clams. Now, was it really an omen, or just a frayed leather strap? Is it a coincidence? Maybe. Maybe not. But do you really want to take the chance and buy those clams? Now, there are some really bad omens that are more obvious. If you're at the races, and someone nearby faints, or worse, has a fit, you might want to stop betting for the day, or even leave early. If you wake up to discover a snake has gotten into your house, or a vulture's landed on your roof, you might want to rethink all of your plans for today. Bumping into a funeral, seeing a dead body, lightning, thunder, any of those things happen, and you better be extra careful. You just might be in for a really bad day. Or, you can just do what you like. Maybe you believe you're in control of your destiny, and that nothing is predetermined. Fate is an illusion, and no hiccup, black cat, or tearing a hole in your toga is going to make you change your plans or your mind. But, if you're that type, I bet you also touched a candle flame more than once as a child, even after your parents warned you not to. We Romans aren't so foolish. We take these things pretty seriously. So much so that bad omens are admissible in court, and considered an acceptable reason for delaying a battle, requesting a different court date, or canceling an appointment or contract. So until next time, be wary and stay safe. Yours, in service to the Empire, Ascarius Tabularis.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Man, that is so good.
Yeah. That's very important life lessons. Thank you, Ascarius.
Next, we have the first installment of a little segment called Detention with Mr. Tyler. This episode is called Earth to Earth.
Quiet down, quiet down. You're all here in detention because of the horrible, unnameable, and blasphemous things you wrote on Mrs. Waite's blackboard. And it's far better you're here with me than any punishment she can think of. Trust me. Now, I don't want to be here any more than you do, so we're going to talk about whatever I want to talk about. And today we're talking about a fantastic short story by poet and crank historian Robert Graves, Earth to Earth. At 4 pages long, it's not only a fantastic short story, it's a fantastically short story. And yet in those 4 pages, Robert Graves gives a chilling and horrifying but completely vague story of obsession and degeneration. In many ways, cosmic horror, or at least Lovecraftian horror, is marked by evocative and intriguing details, but with many empty spaces between them that we get to think about and expand on. The horrible things that are just beyond our senses and our reckoning. Our story starts in South Devon in 1940. The unnamed narrator brings us the case of two friends of his, Elsie and Roland Hedge, a young childless couple who have recently become interested in the teachings of a self-styled natural philosopher from Germany named Dr. Eugene Steinpils. Elsie and Roland have dinner with Dr. Steinpils and are amazed by the tasty vegetables he grows in his garden, much more delicious than the vegetables they can buy in the market, so they decide to try his method of composting and his recipe to create a bacteria able to break down the compost very efficiently. Dr. Steinpils dies during a German air raid, but the Hedges carry on his good work and continue composting in their backyard. The heap grows and grows until there is no room for a garden. There is just the compost pile sitting there breaking down everything Elsie and Roland put into it. The two start doing fairly disgusting tasks to collect the ingredients necessary for composting. They abandon the bathroom in their home and set up an outhouse on top of the heap so they can directly add to it. Roland follows cows on their way to market so he can collect their droppings. Elsie saves their bath water so she can spray it into the pile because it contains, as she says, valuable animal salts. And all this is during the Blitz, when every patriotic Brit scrounges whatever they can for national defense. Somehow, Roland and Elsie always have organic matter to feed the bacteria in the compost pile. One night, an old sailor who's been bombed out of his house comes to the Hedges and demands to stay the night. Roland confesses to the narrator that the sailor had a heart attack and died. Knowing how overworked the police are from the chaos of German bombings, they decide to do the next best thing. They remove all metal objects, the non-biodegradable bits, and put his body in the compost heap. That spring, a policeman comes to the house because the Hedges left their lights on during a blackout. Roland looks out the window but doesn't come to the door. The policeman breaks in the next day, finding Roland and Elsie dead from an overdose of sleeping pills. Next to them is a note saying, "Please lay our bodies on the heaps next to the pigsty, flowers by request. Strew some on the bodies, mix with a little kitchen waste, and then fork the earth lightly over. E.H. R.H." Soon after, the home's new owner wants to grow potatoes in the yard, so he clears out the fungoid heaps, revealing 5 human skeletons picked clean by the bacteria. The first time I read Earth to Earth, I thought it was just all right. But then I started having fun theorizing about what's actually going on. What are the Hedges up to? And why are they throwing away their lives for the sake of decomposing organic matter? Graves gives us just enough room and just enough details that we can sort of theorize, come up with our own answers. Here are a couple of my own. This is a story about parasitism. There's a fungus named Orpheocordyceps, if I'm saying that correctly, also known as the zombie ant fungus, whose spores take over an ant's nervous system and force the ant to help spread its spores throughout the colony. It's possible that Elsie and Roland have become the drones of this bacteria, which thrives in the compost, and so they begin feeding it and just keep feeding it, and over time that's all they're living for, that they are basically just the hands that are pushing food into the mouth of this bacteria. That would certainly explain how it becomes such an obsession, how it consumes their lives. Perhaps it's just guilt that killed them in the end, I suppose, in a moment of clarity and in sheer panic of adrenaline. Perhaps they had clarity over what they've become. A second possibility is that this is a story all about the Hedges' attempts to get a child through Dr. Steinpils' natural philosophy. There are a couple mentions throughout the story about them being a childless couple. Whether Steinpils is a crank or not, it's possible Roland and Elsa believe that he would be able to get them a child through some sort of occult process. If you look at the list of ingredients that go into creating the bacteria, some of them sort of seem a bit more like a witch's brew than anything else. A bull's foot, a goat's pancreas, all mixed in a ram's horn, all these symbols of fertility. And this recipe is referred to as the mother, which is a bit strange as well. So it almost seems as though they're creating a fertile environment. It's interesting the frequent use of human remains and human waste put into the compost pile, perhaps. Maybe that's the blueprint. It's mentioned that the compost pile is incredibly warm on the inside. Decaying matter releases heat as it decomposes. Quite famously, alligators create a nest of old leaves, which they then lay their eggs into, and that keeps the eggs warm. It's an incubator, and it's possible that this compost heap is also an incubator, too. And that's the real beauty of this story. You can interpret any meaning you want to into these 4 pages. During next detention, we'll look a little bit deeper into some things we can pull out and put into Call of Cthulhu role-playing games. But till then, stay out of trouble, okay?
I really like that.
Nice.
That was awesome.
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
Thank you, Mr. Tyler.
Is anybody else thinking about the trash heap from the Fraggle Rock?
I never knew it was a womb until now.
Yeah, sure. Well, it's, you know, the mystical mother.
Yeah, it's where doozers come from.
Yeah. That, by the way, was by Samuel. It's Samuel Tyler, and he has a link for a blog that we're going to put in the show notes. The blog is called Skullduggery in the Smoke. Check it out. And finally, we have we travel to the Land of the Rising Sun for a segment about stigmatized properties in Japan.
Finding a new home in today's real estate market can be challenging enough for anyone. And if you're lucky, you may just find a new home for a steal. But buyer beware. Cheap homes have histories, some that are merely bothersome, and some that are truly twisted. For new Japanese homeowners, it's the latter that are very real realities, which are better left avoided and unspoken. Waki Are Buken, or real estate listings with reasons, are stigmatized properties on the Japanese real estate market. These properties can be near undesirable locations such as hangouts for the Yakuza, or perhaps being involved in legal entanglements, or even something as annoying as undesirable facilities like waste treatment centers. Inconvenient places to be sure, but not unlivable. But it is jikobuken, or accidental properties, that can call forth frightful images in prospective Japanese homeowners. These can be sites related to religious cults and deaths, be they natural or unnatural like accidents, murder, or suicide. Jikobuken sites can often cause psychological harm to Japanese tenants, with some reporting residual smells left behind by the decomposing corpse, or some developing insomnia due to psychological pressure from what occurred in the room. Even a natural death in an apartment complex can make for a hard sell for real estate agencies, which is why they don't rent out to the elderly. In 2001, a man's remains was found in his apartment in Chiba, 3 years after he died, with no friends or family, and his rent being automatically deducted every month, he would have surely died a lonely death. These deaths are called kodokushi and haunt the Japanese imagination. In Japanese belief, the reikon, or soul, of the departed enters a state of purgatory until proper burial rites have been completed, where they will then join their ancestors. However, failure to do so, or the death being unnatural, or being consumed by emotions like revenge, love, hatred, or jealousy upon death can breed particularly vengeful spirits, called yurei, that can linger in a place, keeping the soul trapped and resentful towards the living. Such a spirit may have been in an apartment in Ueno, Tokyo, where the body of an 80-year-old woman was found 5 months after her death. The apartment was renovated and converted to an Airbnb, and for a time, there were no real complaints. One tenant, however, was inexplicably locked out, requiring the intervention of the landlord. It was later revealed that it was locked from the inside, with the security latch on, as if they were being kept out of the apartment. Oshimaland.com is a website that lists stigmatized properties throughout Japan, viewable through Google Maps. It lists hotspots with information on what kind of tragedy occurred there, with such examples like body sightings, people jumping to their deaths, perishing in fires, and a peculiar case of a 27-year-old man in Kobe killing himself by inhaling helium gas in a public toilet. The website has also expanded to areas outside of Japan, with listings across the globe. The site also allows users to add their own notes about particular stigmatized properties. Realtors in Japan are required by law to disclose whether homes have histories attached 5 to 7 years after the incident in question, but some realtors have found loopholes to disclose such information only once, to the tenant or buyer immediately following the incident in question. Some of these tactics include having a temporary tenant serve out the remaining time, or changing the registered name of the deceased tenant to a relative, thus avoiding the embarrassment of informing future tenants of the recent tragedy. At worst, they could even lie and say that the person was merely found at the home and died en route to the hospital. Interestingly, young Japanese adults are not deterred by risking stigmatized properties. The cheaper rent, sometimes slashed to $100 to $200 a month, can be too hard to resist for a startup within a notoriously expensive city like Tokyo. And big realtors, perhaps desperate to unload these tainted properties, are trying to put a more positive spin on these apartments, using ghost mascots and cute jingles, with one particular advert going as far as pushing qualities like its low initial cost, or the fact it's perfect for lonely singles, as you'll be living alone, but you'll never really feel like it.
Yeah, I like that last bit.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Nice ending note.
That was really, really cool.
I really enjoyed all three of these.
Right?
Those are so good.
Oh, love our listeners.
It's like a little variety show section.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was by Jonathan, also known as Flashback J.
Thank you so much. That was beautiful.
Really good job there, man.
Thanks very much. Hope that we hear more about Japan and about ancient Rome and potentially about detention. I don't know.
What? Detention.
Yes.
More detention.
Settle down now, Klaus. It's time for your next lesson.
All right, and for the main topic, we have with us once again our friend from Darker Hue Studios, Chris Spivey. Hey, Chris.
Hey, everyone. Glad to be here.
Awesome.
Glad to have
you
back.
Nice to have you, man.
Welcome, welcome.
Good to have you.
Last time it was pre-Harlem Unbound. Now we are post-Harlem Unbound. And I have it sitting here next to me in a beautiful horde cover.
I am glad to hear that. I'm a little bit, I'm kind of fond of the book myself.
I can imagine.
Same.
We've had some interesting accolades for it that I've never encountered for a role-playing game before.
Yeah, I don't. This might be new, right? I don't think I've heard of this before. It doesn't mean it hasn't happened, but it turns out, if I'm not mistaken, that the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the Smithsonian Institution, Anacostia Community Museum, and the Newark Museum have acquired this book, Harlem Unbound, because of its artistic, scholarly, and educational value for their special collections. Is that all true?
That is correct. I reached out to them a while back, and I was surprised that they responded. And once they accepted the book, I was really humbled and just really happy that the African-American story is getting out there and getting a chance to shine a light on the Harlem Renaissance.
It's fantastic.
That is awesome.
Yeah, that's amazing, man. Kudos to you, dude.
Thank you.
Have you ever heard of any other RPG having that kind of position in the? Do they have stuff from the RPG world?
Not that I know of. I know that when the Met even commented that it's not something that they normally do, but they accepted it, and I'm just really, really happy about that. And I let Chaosium know the other day, and Moeb was nice enough to put the word out for me.
I think I read it on your Facebook, and then I saw it popping up on the Chaosium blog, and it's all over the place. It's awesome.
So I'm still a little bit in shock right now, but I feel really good about it.
You should. I mean, that's a hell of an achievement.
Yeah, it was a great idea to think of that. Can you talk us through the process a little bit, how that all came about?
Well, so everyone knows that when I originally made the book, I had a sort of multi-tiered goal in mind for it, one of which was to educate people about the Harlem Renaissance, to address issues that were in Lovecraft, that as a reader of Lovecraft since I was 12, it's always sort of been a thing for me, and I want to try to overcome that. And taking all of that in mind, I spent a lot of time in Harlem. I went to the Schomburg Center. I researched some other museums, and when I was at the Schomburg Center, the first time I actually talked to them about what I would need to do if I wanted to add the book to their collection. And that sort of started me on the idea that I should reach out to some other places also and see if they would want to accept the book, because it's artistically beautiful. The work that the entire crew put into it was exceptional, and it's a statement. And all art should be a statement and a protest of some kind.
Hear, hear.
Yeah.
It's pretty awesome that, in particular, the Anacostia Community Museum is a pretty great project in itself. So to be occupying a little bit of real estate there is kind of amazing. So, you know, that is one data point in the whole picture of how the response has been, but, you've also gotten a lot of great press, a lot of great reviews. I think it seems people are really recognizing that this is an important book, as well as a well-written one and a playable one, you know, a gameable one.
I've got a lot of accolades for the book, which I'm really happy about because I spent a lot of time debating almost every single word that went into the book, whether or not it was the right choice, whether or not I should be doing this. Maybe this would be a better idea. And to hear that people are enjoying it and that it's making some sort of impact with them is really fulfilling in one sense. But I've also seen a lot of people saying that it's a great book. I am glad that I own it, but it's not something that I could run.
Yeah, That's interesting. Have you been able to engage with that? Have you had conversations about that?
I haven't really had a chance to engage with people about it, that I've seen some random Facebook posts and some of the comments and reviews, but it's something that I really want to start attempting to do because I understand that they're enjoying it and they're glad they have it, but unless they're actually playing the game and sort of reinforcing the message in the book, that message is going to die out. And I don't want that to happen.
Right.
Yeah, that's an odd take to have a game book that you really enjoy and are happy to have, but then can't play it. I'd be interested to hear what the answers are for that.
I would have to say it's not terribly surprising that there might be discomfort from people who are not African American, who are approaching this subject for possibly the first time in a gaming realm, that there may be a barrier to entry. So I'm hoping that that barrier will be overcome. I guess conversations are the only way to have that happen.
Pretty much. And so that's one of the reasons I'm actually trying to look at getting on panels at different conventions so I can at least talk about the book and maybe help address some issues that people are having in a larger impact than just on one-on-one, which one-on-one is important. But at the same time, there's only one me, so I can't go to every single gamer sort of knocking on the door. Hello, I would like to talk to you about Harlem Unbound and why you should run it.
Right.
Well, I mean, let's imagine that we are those people. I mean, you have an audience here. They're all listening. So, I mean, what would you tell to those people if you could talk to them right now?
Some of the things I put in the book, that you're going to make mistakes when you're trying to run this type of game. Just there's no way around it. And as long as you come to it with good intentions, you're willing to acknowledge that you've made those mistakes and try to do better next time and potentially apologize to anyone that you've run the game for that you've offended, that is a solid first step and you should be taking those to run the game. It goes back to that you could even have the X card that I forgot John's last name that created it, but it's a great thing where anyone feels uncomfortable, they can just sort of touch the card and then you will move away from that specific topic. And also right. Layered the game itself with multiple tiers of play so you can sort of decide what your group is the most comfortable with for real history.
And do you have is there a built-in kind of gauge at the beginning for not just keepers, for keepers to present to the entire group before play starts on one of those?
In the keeper section, there is, I sort of give three tiers of play and a brief example of them and describe what I think a keeper should do. Because all the onus for the game, as all games, in my opinion, is primarily on the keeper. Because you're bringing all these people together, you're running a game for them, and you need to make sure that everyone in the game is comfortable. So the players show up, they bring their character, and they bring their A game to delve into this world, but it's up to you to make sure that everything sort of stays balanced, they're comfortable, but they're also engaging with the real history that it's presenting. And the three tiers are presented, there's basically one that just sort of touches on everything and lets you glide through the history and see things. And then it gets into more detail and there's penalty dice that will come into effect at higher tiers. And then there's sort of like gritty reality that the players can engage with that I don't think that many people will play with. I've run one or two games like that, but a lot of people don't necessarily want that level of intensity for gritty reality and then the mythos directly on top of the gritty reality.
And so it's quite harsh, in other words. I mean, if you go with gritty reality plus, you know, a mythos overtones, then you're potentially in a rather upsetting or deadly campaign or game.
It shines the faintest of light on what it would be like to be an African American in 1920s and still how it is today.
What would you tell white gamers that are having some issue coming into the subject matter in general? Like who understand that it's a good book, but you know, they just have that barrier between them and the material that they just don't feel comfortable with presenting to their group. I mean, how would you get them past that? Cause that might, I mean, I'm just playing devil's advocate at this point, but I mean, how would you get them past that barrier?
You can piecemeal it into your group and put in little hints of it throughout the campaign bit by bit. Part of the thing is though, is that it may be somewhat uncomfortable and you're trying to understand a new world. But if you're a D&D player, it's not like that you're living beside an elf. The dwarf is your next door neighbor and the three of you go out to dinner together and you don't understand their culture. It's the same sort of premise that this is something that it's not your reality, but you're trying to play it, engage with it. And this is something that may not necessarily be a reality or it could be, but you're still engaging with it and teaching it to other people.
Yeah, that's a good point to make, that it's the same essential strange dichotomy you have there between, you know, the typical D&D player and the other races, quote unquote, as it is between the typical white elitist investigators that we typically see versus the gritty reality of an African American in that time, New York.
But it's just something that's really important to me, and I think that people should be attempting to engage it and run it, and then you sort of reinforce those ideals, and then you learn more about yourself and other people. It's one of the great things about gaming is that you're building community, and in that community, you're sharing experiences and stories. And those experiences and stories, you're going out and you're telling your other friends about it. And they may get an interest in the book. They may say, hey, you know, I've been gaming for 20 years and I've never gamed with anyone that's not another white male. And that has someone stopping and think that, well, maybe I should try to expand my circle a little bit.
And you've actually got quite a bit of material on how to help people who are approaching this material freshly as far as advice on one of the pieces of advice is battling blackface is the subtitle here as far as don't try to do as a white player, lean into stereotypes or do what they think of as a black accent and to, you know, just to increase sensitivity. You've got several pages here on how to help players and keepers enter this material and deal with that discomfort.
It's a whole new experience for some people. And one of the ways that you sort of counterbalance that uncertainty is to provide useful, relevant information for someone and give them tools to combat problems they're going to have. And if people have real questions, they can either decide to go online and try to research answers for themselves. I've had some people that have sent me emails and tweets about certain things. I've had people reach out, and once again, I'm just one person and I'll try to help people if I can, but you need to talk to other people. That's like one of the key cruxes of the entire book. And you need to talk to people that aren't in your circles. It's the same thing that I'm saying to anyone in the industry that I know that wants to write about the African American experience, the indigenous people's experience, women's experience, LGBTQ experience. I tell them they need to reach out to those groups and have someone from that group work with them on that project and pay them for their time and give them full credit. That's how the industry builds itself and gets a wider reach. And I hope that Harlem Unbound is one of the steps in making that happen.
It's an incredible conversation starter, and it does it in a way that's really familiar to Call of Cthulhu players. I mean, it actually has great scenarios in it for which to grind that whetstone.
All right, I'm going to put you on the spot.
Sure.
What's your favorite scenario out of the book?
Well, definitely Hellfighters. Harlem Hellfighters Never Die is an awesome scenario. And I'd like to run it. It is, it takes you deep into the experience of returning soldiers from World War I. It's, you know, it's got a rich cultural backdrop, but it's also just a really fun,
fun piece of horror, of gaming horror, full stop.
That one's kind of special to me, being an African-American vet. It's something I wanted to do to honor people that came before me that don't necessarily get a lot of honor or recognition for the service they provided, and to come back home and to be treated worse than what they were before they left in most cases.
It's got some great background about that. It's got really great historical sections. But yeah, also the badness that you face is really rich and fascinating, layered. I'm sort of trying to dance around some...
spoilers?
Yeah. Well, maybe could you summarize for us?
I will say that one of the things that I wanted to do for the book is sort of establish that there's evil. The mythos is more malevolent, and it doesn't really care about humanity. It might use humanity for its own ends, but it will never say team up side by side with some group to destroy some other group. And the actual evil in the book is more human evil in what humans will do and the reasons they do it. And humans themselves may attempt to use a mythos for their own ends, but that normally has horrible repercussions for everyone involved. And I wanted to establish that there's evil, and the evil itself isn't insane. It's thought out. It's logical. It's human. And some of the greatest horrors committed, I think, in the entire book itself, even in the scenarios and the background that's presented, are human atrocities that have been committed.
Yeah, absolutely. It's sort of reminds me a little bit of Lovecraft Country in that way, in its exploration of human horrors being the worst possible threat.
I've had a number of people mention Lovecraft Country to me. I actually had a couple of people buy the book because they said they read Lovecraft Country, and when they were doing a Google search, Harlan Bound popped up.
Oh, see, that's cool.
Nice. That's synergy.
I've been browsing through the PDF I picked up, and I'm looking forward to actually using these hints for roleplay, because when I am a player, which is not often, but when I do play, I do try and make a character that is not of myself. So I know folks who, when they play, they almost always try and make a female character. They like to gender reverse. I do tend to try and make like black characters, but my problem is I play them as if they're still me. It's just I've changed my skin color. And so I'm looking forward to being able to really get in here and find character motivations, and that I can try and be authentic in the role play. So thank you for that as a resource.
You're welcome.
So are you going to Gen Con? You are going to Gen Con.
Gen Con is my con. I've tried to go to other cons, but it doesn't necessarily always work out. But I've already got my hotel room booked for Gen Con. I've actually registered to run two games for Harlem Unbound while I'm at Gen Con this year.
Cool.
And I actually need to write said scenario now.
Oh, there's some good motivation. You're already on the hook.
You can't back out now.
So that's kind of interesting.
I actually did. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say it's interesting that you're writing more stuff, because it leads to one of the questions, which is there going to be more? Are you taking this to book two or new settings, or, you know, what are you doing?
Well, I've had people ask me about the two new towns that I created in Harlem Unbound, where I sort of give an offhanded mention.
Attics and
Harbor Mill.
Harbor Mill. Yep.
And I've had people ask, so when are we getting these supplement books?
Yes, please.
And for the moment, I'm focusing on trying to finish my last Kickstarter goal, which is one additional scenario for all my Kickstarter backers, the new Gen Con scenario. And I may have reached out to a couple people and had them create a couple of short scenarios that I will attempt to put out sometime soon.
Awesome.
Cool.
After those, it's probably going to be a close on Harlem for a while.
Okay. Mm-hmm. A close on Harlem, or a close on Call of Cthulhu settings and worlds of African-American America in the 20s?
I will only say a close on Harlem for a while.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's a pretty interesting way to put it.
I may have been project planning out some things recently.
Awesome.
But I can't really go into a lot of them at this time until I really finish up all the Harlem Unbound stuff, because I made a promise to my backers, and I'm going to fulfill my promise because they let this happen. And it was through their support and everything else that it went to the museum, that you guys are reading it right now, that people are talking about it, and that it's making a difference.
Yeah.
Fair point. We still would love for you to leak stuff, but all right, whatever.
Since it's you guys and you're nice enough to have me back, I will tell you a little something about Redacted.
Yay! Oh, wait. Wait, is that the actual damn name of it?
That is not the name. That is a name. Okay.
All right.
I can give you the code name that I have for it. This one's called Alpha, if that gives you an idea of what it's what you should expect it.
It really doesn't.
Alpha is something that I pitched probably in 2014 or 2015 to someone. And they liked it, so it was something I was sort of working on in the background, but Harlem Unbound became sort of like my primary focus. And now that Harlem Unbound is mostly done, other than these few outstanding scenarios, I'm also working on Redacted. And Redacted actually has gone through, I've had some playtests, I have a few more playtests coming up, and I am really, really excited about it.
Cool. Okay.
That's good. I'm glad you're doing something else at least.
There's a thing and it's progressing.
Yes.
Okay.
And hopefully I can talk about it in more detail in the next couple months.
Okay.
Oh, excellent.
Well, that's just another reason to come back on the show there.
Keep us posted.
So that's what I'm really working on right now for next.
Okay.
Sounds great.
And I could have something really big in the works, but that may be like a year away or more.
Okay.
Well, is there anything else you want to make sure we don't miss here?
Well, I'd like to mention my Patreon.
Sure.
So if anyone wants to give me money to try to help other people get into gaming to support other sort of diverse creatives and get their voices out there. And I would like to mention the gaming store in Brooklyn that's having their own Harlem Unbound Day.
Oh, I have that. Yes.
That has nothing to do with me.
Cool. I'm hoping to get there. Yeah.
I want to. I'm trying, but I just don't know if it's going to happen.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't want to run. I just want to show up when people are running and sit in the corner with, like, a beer. March 25th, I think, at Anyone Comics.
I was wondering, Chris, could you tell us about your team that worked on Harlem Unbound? The art is utterly amazing. Just rolling through this thing, I am loving the art.
So when I started the book, originally it was just me alone with a beer and a Word doc. That was around 2013. I pitched it to a couple of people and they weren't necessarily on board with it. And I reached out to a friend of mine and who I believed was a great artist who would sort of understand what I was trying to do. And so that's how Nino sort of came on board with the project, and Nino brought his friend Phil. And those were the two artists at the start of it. And it was still sort of moving along. I had put in some different versions of the book. I had some preliminary artwork. Then randomly, I got an email when I was going to go to Metatopia in 2015 from a Brennan Reese, and says, "Hey, are you the Chris that went to Auburn?" And I said, "Yes, random internet stranger. That is who I am." And Brennan says, "I went to Auburn too." And so then the two of us sort of met up in Metatopia over Scotch, and we talked about a lot of stuff, catching up. We always knew of each other, but we're never really close. And he was a great artist. He was a great designer. He was totally in the groove of the book that I was trying to make. And with Brennan sort of becoming the Hamilton to my Washington, we spearheaded the rest of the book. And with some of his insight, mm-hmm. and showing the different artistic styles I wanted in the book, he really sort of helped shape that part. And I'd fortunately enough met Neil also at Metatopia that year. And I twisted Neil's arm because I love Cthulhu. And a lot of the history in some of the older Cthulhu books is a little, I won't say dry, but I will say that it lacks the certain flavor that Neil could bring to it. So that's why I wanted Neil specifically to write the history section. And then I would go back and I would give Neil more sort of direct his amazing writing ability to very specific points I wanted to hit. And so that's why the history, when you read it, feels vibrant and it feels alive. And it has the very soul itself of what Harlem is through a Scion lens, is really the best way to put it. And I was working on Cthulhu Confidential with Ruth, and Ruth was doing New York for Cthulhu Confidential. So I may have convinced her that all of her great New York knowledge would be excellent to be used in the 20s. And she brought on Sarah, who helped sort of tighten up some of the different sections, some of the geographical sections, and a couple of the bios that I had written also. And Bob, who is my buddy and my cohort at Gen Con, because I ran a lot of games for U2K and Cthulhu for a couple of years. And Bob is sort of the mastermind behind that, stepped in. I told him that I wanted a scenario. I told him roughly what a scenario about, and I gave it to Bob. And Bob is a old hand at Lovecraft. And that scenario is heartbreaking in everything that a Lovecraftian scenario should be. And fortunately, I also met Rachel, who is an amazing copy editor, and she made everything perfect. She caught all of our writer typos, every single mistake that we had, and she would highlight it for us and then would go back, and it was all massaged into place.
Nice.
And Alex. Alex is amazing. Some of his artwork in the Harlem Nights was stunning. It was exactly what I asked him for. Alex was a friend of Brennan's. When I told Brennan I wanted one more artist to come in to try to do some very quick work, someone reliable I could depend on, he's like, Alex, we'll blow you away. And he did.
Yeah, this is a stunning project. And the art is just blowing me away. Mm-hmm. I'm loving it.
Yeah, it's unlike anything I've ever seen in a role-playing game, regardless of what the game is. It's very unique, and I think that's part of the charm of this book, is that it's got such a unique appearance as well as the fantastic content.
It stands out on the shelf. That's one of the things I wanted it to do.
Uh-huh.
I want to make sure you used all first names, and I want to go back and just say you're talking about Brennan Reese. You're talking about Bob Geist. Tell me if I'm pronouncing anything wrong. Ruth Tillman, Alex Mayo, Sarah Hood, Neil Raymond Price.
Yes.
Yep. And
Nino Malong. Philip, Jean, Pierre,
and Phil,
Jill Spivey. Oh, and I see Jean-Pierre and Jennifer Harlett helped with editing,
and Rachel Wolf.
Yeah, this is a huge team. This is great.
I called in a lot of favors to make the book happen, and fortunately, my wife Jill, who I am glad that she's here and happy that she has suffered through the long, arduous process that was me getting this book out. And she is a great editor. She was my first round editor. I bounce ideas off of her and she takes it all in stride. And I called in my friends Jeff and Ginny to sort of help out with some additional editing because I wanted to make sure that we caught as many typos as possible.
Well, it's fantastic. People should pick it up. It's also got lots of, sort of how to form scenarios and how to GM and advice that's good for everyone.
I'm a huge fan of scenario ideas. So that's why the book is also littered with scenario hooks. Cause I know as a keeper, I bought games before reading through them. I was like, well, that's kind of interesting. I wonder what the writer would suggest for a scenario for that. And so I wanted people to have lots of different scenario, little branches or little tidbits they could run with. And I'm really proud of the incredibly silly, but yet useful, random scenario generator that's in the book and on the keeper screen.
Yeah. Yes. I saw that. Yeah. I saw that. That was really cool. Yeah. I mean, it's a setting. It's a, you know, a setting book where you can, you know, have an entire campaign set in Harlem. You can have, Harlemite investigators. And all the scenario hooks and everything. This is
now that you mentioned. Awesome. One of my patrons the other day sort of sent me a question asking about Master Nolothotep. They're waiting for the last big sort of push for Chaosium for it to come out in their companions books, and they're like, "So while I'm waiting, I really want to have my players run through Harlem. And what suggestions would you have to do that?" Oh, yeah. And I provided some suggestions about how to sort of interweave different parts of Mask into the Harlem scenarios as they run them So when their characters get ready to actually enter the Master of Nullothotep campaign, they've already got little tidbits of information that directly sort of link into some of the scenarios. And they've built up their own network in New York before they leave for the rest of the world.
Did you do that over email or what? How did that happen?
It was on the Patreon.
If people wanted to subscribe to your Patreon, would they have access to that?
Yes. They may be able to see it without it. I think it may be in the community part. I would have to double check.
That seems like something that a lot of people will may well soon need or want to do with Mass Coming.
And I may have also been a little happy that I got to do a preliminary read over some of the new Mask of Nullothotep.
Ooh.
That's great.
New York chapter. I'm just saying.
That's a great idea. All. That way they can really improve on that with better historical accuracy and just interesting flavor.
You're not joking there.
Yes. Time for riffing.
Guess what's the bumper now, though, Chad? So we had a couple of different riff prompts that we had presented to you, and you chose two separate ones that you might want to do. So now I'm going to put you on the spot and ask you to choose one of them.
Television.
Good choice.
All right. So what TV show plot could you rip off for a Call of Cthulhu scenario or campaign?
I would love to do a Call of Cthulhu campaign for Life on Mars.
Oh
my God. Thank you.
Because that is just perfect. It's waiting to be used. You've got like
that the- is got to be some of the best damn television they have made in the last decade.
Which version of it? I know there was an American one and the original British and
the UK version.
Okay. That's what I assume.
Not the UK version.
The UK. The American version is complete crap.
That's what I assumed. I just wanted to make sure it was
the
clear.
The UK version is fantastic.
And even Ashes to Ashes was good too. So it's,
I loved Ashes to Ashes. It was great. The whole series, that whole world verse was fantastic.
All right. For listeners, including myself, who haven't seen it, give me a summary of the series. Give me the elevator pitch.
Okay. So elevator pitch is, you're set in modern day, initially modern day London, and a police inspector is investigating a series of murders that have odd links to this serial killer in the 70s.
Oh, right.
However, he is hit by a car and put into a coma. This happens episode one, so no one's really freaking surprised about it. That's not a spoiler. However, when he wakes up, he is in 1970s Manchester. And he's still him, but he's dressed like he's in the 70s. He's got a 1970s warrant card. He's known as a similar name in the 70s. It's mind-boggling. But it turns out that this same serial killer is active. And there are a lot of strange twists and turns that happen.
Including encounters with his younger self.
Yep.
It's
his mother.
It's crazy.
Incredible.
It's great. Really, really good television. And it, like Chris said, it is witty as hell. It's funny at times, just laugh out loud funny. But it's not a comedy. It's just a straight up strange, weird take on a police procedural.
And one of the things is throughout the entire series, you don't really know if he's in a coma or if he's actually back in time.
Okay.
And that sort of plays throughout the entire series.
Right. And there was a spinoff of that called Ashes to Ashes, where a similar setup happened to a different police inspector, but this time she went back to the 80s and she met the same supporting cast as
Gene Hunt
with Gene Hunt and the gang, as the original character did in Life on Mars. And that kind of followed it through and answered more and more questions as those three seasons went through. It's good television. I mean, it's just the only downside to Americans listening to it is you have got to have an ear, and be able to give it a little bit of time so you can adjust to the Manchurian accent.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. Manchester's nice and thick. That's cool.
It is a thick accent. But once you get a couple episodes in, it's no worries. And then Ashes to Ashes is more London-based, so it's still the characters are still from Manchester, but they're now in London, so it's not as heavy as it was originally in Life on Mars, but it's definitely worth a watch.
So Chris, where's the mythos layer that pops to mind? Why that?
Why Life on Mars? Simply because, for one, you don't know if it's potentially a Yithian sort of encounter where he's sort of sucked back potentially into a different body from back then, or it could be a Nolothotep sort of thing where Nolothotep is playing with him and has potentially like the fate of humanity resting on who's ever PC shoulders are running around and their interactions during that time.
Nice.
It could even go that you sort of move to not the Dreamlands, but an intermediary sort of plane where you're playing out with these characters that you know aren't real, but they feel real enough that you're still engaging with them. And while you're doing all of that, potentially your bodies could be in the middle of trying to stop a cult from doing some sort of ritual, and the campaign follows you doing all these things over the course of a year or two, but in reality it's 10 seconds and your real body is doing something else, and it's a spell that the cultists use to sort of snap your will so they can successfully do what they need to do.
There's like an expanding alternate reality where something is being played out that affects the real world,
and there's so many directions to go with it. It's brilliant.
Oh yeah, the idea of a campaign that takes place in the course of 10 seconds in PC's real world is pretty cool.
So, just out of morbid curiosity now, because you piqued my interest. Are you a British television fan?
I am a huge BBC fan.
Oh,
British television fan.
Dude.
It's, I grew up watching Doctor Who, Blake 7. I know it all.
You know it all. Are you a Morse fan?
No, Inspector Morse didn't do it for me.
Oh my god. What about the spinoff, Lewis?
No, I can give you more of the Agatha Christie.
Okay, do that.
Which coupling?
Which version of Marple? Which version of Marple?
I'm going to go with the one from the early 2000s that probably ran to 2008, where they sort of changed Marples around season 3 to 4.
Right. 3, whenever, yeah. That was a good one. I like that. I can't beat the, what's her name? The old one from the 80s.
Ah, she was really good too.
That they just remastered all of those. And so now they look glorious on HD. It's great.
And I know that people love the new Sherlock that came out, but I've got to go with the one from the 90s.
Hell yeah, dude. Hell yeah. Yeah, I am a ridiculous Anglophile when it comes to British television. I absorb it at ridiculous amounts. It's insane.
What about the rest of you guys?
Yes, although we did just wandered into a different podcast. How do we get here?
Hush. This is my dream podcast, British television. Come on.
All right, then, Murph, I got one for you.
All right.
Did you ever see Strange? It's got Jeff from Coupling as a priest that battles the supernatural.
Yes.
Awesome.
Okay, we're going obscure. Did you watch the?
No. Let's get, because you guys might step on mine. I also have a British.
Okay. Oh.
All right.
Yeah. You want me to go?
Yeah. Go ahead.
All right. Misfits.
Oh yes. Who hasn't seen Misfits? Come on, that's like
great, dude.
Mandatory watching.
Yeah, Misfits is amazing. I loved it. I really enjoyed the first 3 seasons more than the other 2, but still, I loved all of it. So Misfits, for those who are not in the know, Misfits was a British, but it was like a sci-fi comedy, superpowers, drama. I mean, it had a lot of comedy, but also drama. Show where these kids, teenagers, young adults who are juvenile delinquents, and they're sentenced to community service. So they have to put on orange jumpsuits, and they have to, you know, parole officers or whatever are watching them, and they have to go in and clean up different public areas, right? And so while they're doing community service, and, you know, of course, nobody likes each other. They all hate being there. They just want to get out of there and, you know, go back and do whatever it is that they're doing. There's a weird electrical storm outside. And so basically anybody who is outdoors on a certain day at a certain time under this electrical storm were bestowed superpowers. And so then there's the whole thing where they're discovering these powers and what they do with them. It was really, really cool. And they do some really kind of cool time travel, trope, or they play with time travel, tell an interesting storyline with that, with, resurrection kind of powers and stuff like that. So I think Misfits, or a concept like Misfits, could be a really cool Cthulhu campaign hook, where maybe the investigators, as well as others, are all in an event. They all are affected by some sort of event that changes them all somehow, and some, the investigators will gain. Maybe one of them gains a spell, or one of them can now control and morph into a deep one or something. Or something, not maybe full deep one, but, do a little bit of hybrid or something, get a clawed hand or something like that. Just kind of see how that goes and where you can take it. You could really, I would think, penalize the characters. The player characters, as they, for every time they use it, maybe have a sanity,
cost,
penalty that they have to pay. Yeah, there's a sanity cost to it, so that what seemed kind of cool and powerful and flashy to begin with starts eroding at the character, and unless they find a way to, make a balance in their life with it, to where they're not overly abusing it, it'll cost them their sanity, and thus cost them the ability to just control themselves and stay, for lack of a better term, on the side of good. And then there could be others NPCs that give in and go, full force into it, and so they become the adversaries.
Nice.
Yeah. That could be fun.
Cool.
Yeah, we talked about mythos informed superheroes a few times now, and I feel like there's a lot of possibilities there and a lot of different ways you could handle it, knowing or unknowing, sanity costs versus, straight up just empowered by the mythos.
What about you, Dan?
Well, as far as British TV or just
No, just TV in general.
For TV plot possibilities for conversion. Well, one that I actually was writing up as a scenario many, many years ago was that I actually was taking the plots from a couple of episodes of X-Files and was going to make them into a scenario. The ones with Toombs, because he's very mythos.
Right.
It's the guy that's in a coma for decades at a time and then wakes up and crawls out of a air duct system or something to eat people's livers and then goes back again.
That's a weird.
It just felt very mythos whenever
X-Files is, X-Files is right.
Those particularly really appealed to me as a potential mythos scenario thing. I've got a spiral somewhere in here with the notes for that. From a couple of decades ago.
Cool. What about Chad?
Oh, man. Well, I can't. Do you know what I'm going to say? Yeah, you do. So I have recently.
Blossom.
No, but close. I have become recently obsessed. I guess I'm going to talk about it now.
Do it.
With a game.
We're all going to shame you. Just get
no, I'm waiting for the shame. I will accept the shame.
No judgments.
There was a game in 1983, I think it came out, called Dallas, the role-playing game.
What?
It is actually a role-playing game based on the television show Dallas, which was...
Oh, I heard.
Yeah, and I bought it. I bought like a $40 copy on eBay.
Oh my God.
As a joke, but listen.
My assumption is that you got printing number one of three, right?
There was something like 20,000 copies made. No, it was, people did.
Tell them who made it though. That's the kicker.
Yeah. Hang on though, because I don't have it in front of me. An incredible, wargaming brain, who made, Panzer Blitz and, other stuff for Avalon Hill ended up designing this thing. And
my guess is on a dare.
Oh, sure. Well,
my guess is for money.
Yeah. A dare of involving money, which is just called commerce or mercenary. But yeah, and it turns out the mechanics are kind of cool. They're sort of like, they're power brokering mechanics. I have no love for this show. Let me be super clear about that.
but Chad,
I don't believe you.
But Chad, aren't you rewatching the show episode by episode?
Because of the role playing game, I started watching the show and it is
called out.
It's so bad and so good. So bad and good.
Oh my God.
And, but listen, I've been thinking lately. I've been thinking, man, like, what if you add some mythos? So I'm thinking, first of all, I mean, it'll be like a frog in a boiling pot kind of thing. I'm going to start by running Dallas just as it is. The cool thing is, by the way, that organizations are NPCs. So I don't know if you've ever played Illuminati, the card game.
Oh,
but
yes.
It sort of has that structure where your goal is to control the press for that episode. And someone else's goal is to control like the oil companies and the labor unions. And so there's this kind of sense of just like power brokering. And then you end up with these structures that I've always loved with Illuminati, where you have, you know, biker gangs controlling the post office or whatever random thing. And so I'm thinking that we bring this to Kingsport and that we play small town Kingsport as a power brokering game using the mechanics of Dallas. Do you see the spirals in my eyes?
I want to play. I want to play.
We can see the spirals.
Oh God. I think I probably will make it happen, but that's it.
That's so awesome.
And that, dear listeners, is what a D4 sounds like when lost.
Life on Mars is a better suggestion, but you know, I just had to.
I love the idea of Dallas with the mythos injected.
Yeah, there's an intermediate step, like actually playing Dallas.
Some of the affairs and the trysts that they have are actually with like deep ones and like, what? Bobby?
Sure. Let me tell you, yeah. Let me qualify the hell out of this though. I have gone back and I am watching the series and it is horrible, but I can't stop. but let me warn you.
That's the sand loss.
Yeah, I know. Uh-huh. I'm already down in I'm in the cultist zone where it's zero. So like I've got nothing to lose. But let me tell you, it is a pageant of, let me tell you, there's like, it's really offensive. So, I'm not endorsing the series Dallas. It's horrible. I mean, really sickeningly horrible.
Yes. But
didn't it run for a decade?
Yes.
A lot of episodes.
Man, who shot JR? Who growing up at that time did not know that? You know, like who shot JR?
You know what? I grew up in Bangor, Maine, which is a tiny little like frontier town. Everybody in Bangor is going to hate me for saying that, but it's, you know, like it's way out there. It was in the front page of our Bangor Daily newspaper. Who shot JR was the headline.
Yeah.
What the hell?
I remember that time. It was a sad state.
I grew up an hour and a half from Houston. So this was almost like real life.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
We mm-hmm. had friends in the oil business, you know, and you knew these kind of people that they were having affairs with, you know, and I mean, you come across those people, you grow up down there. And it was really strange to see some of these people like portrayed on the screen. I remember asking my parents, like, is that really how it is? And my mom's like, no.
There goes Sue Ellen.
I grew up in Houston.
Can somebody?
And having the middle name of Dallas, I had people come up to me all the time. Yeah, how's your show? I'm like, shut up.
Your middle name is Dallas,
my
John?
My middle name is Dallas.
Yeah, this is a new thing.
Dude.
This is a new, you guys knew that.
I didn't know that.
I've never heard that.
If I knew it, I didn't store it until now after I've seen the series for two seasons.
Wait, two seasons?
Two seasons in?
Yeah.
I didn't. Max? Hey, Max.
Yeah.
Can I call for an edit?
There's no editing this, Max.
Can somebody else mention a cheesy 80s TV show to mythosify? Just to get somebody rescue me.
Just Murph is left.
No, I think that was like late 90s, early 2000s.
So I was thinking, I went British because that's what I do. But I had actually thought of the police procedural called River that came out a few years ago. Have you seen that one, Chris?
I've heard of it, but I haven't seen it yet.
So the basic premise is that there is a slightly schizophrenic police detective who's trying to solve his own partner's murder. And he has, you find all this out in the first episode, so I'm not really giving anything away. But he holds conversations with his dead partner on a regular basis. But the way that they shoot it in the show is that he rarely is aware that he's holding a conversation with a dead person. And until they like pan around and you see like the back of her head is missing, and then it shoots to a different camera angle and you see the guy walking away and he's like talking to himself and everybody's staring at him like he's crazy, you know, or, he'll be investigating a murder and for some reason the victim is there with him in the room and they're like commenting kind of like his subconscious would, but they comment in their character as, well, you know, that can't be right because I was over here at that time. So what is he talking about? He must be lying about, you know what I mean? So it's a weird, strange relationship he has with his own neuroses. And I thought that would be kind of cool to explore more fully, in a game setting, at least, to where, you trick the players into not being fully aware of who is really there and who is not there.
Hmm. I like it.
That's cool.
Yeah. Or that's just how it works whenever your detective partner is a sham.
There you go.
Sure. Yep. Yeah, or a few of them in there. Who knows? Yeah. Actually, you know, you could rip off Bluebeard's Bride structurally and have, you know, a single protagonist and all of their...
That's a good idea.
Various avatars solving crimes in one head.
Yeah.
I was also thinking of kind of a Mad Men's Rift where all the players are more or less cultists and they were using like the advertisements to try to corrupt the other world around them till they got a certain number of equivalent people on their side to some catastrophic event. And the constant trials and tribulations that they go through just to do that ad work are your scenarios and everything else. And you don't have physical combats, but you have more personal interaction in sort of a kind of how Star Wars, I think, has a verbal combat system associated with it. And people take strain and everything else, and they go through their lives having to keep the facade of normality while producing all this sanity-shattering work that they give out to the world.
Oh, that's really good.
Can we take that premise and apply it to Chad's Dallas / Kingsport game for power brokering? And then combine the two?
Wait, are you saying the Dallas, the show that Chad has watched two seasons of, and we apply that premise to it?
All right.
Right.
I don't know why you got to...
hedonistic, misogynistic work from the mid to late 80s.
Hammer on that.
We're just combining ideas, Chad. That's all.
Time to move on.
Yeah. We're just bouncing things around, man.
Just slap the sense out of him.
Riff time. I can't take it back.
Yeah, I think a power brokering game amongst Mad Men-esque characters in a PR game trying to one-up one another on mythos cult-related themes. Like, who can bring in the most cultists this week?
You know, how many willing sacrifices can you find?
Yeah, it's like Feed the Shoggoth, but it's a TV show based on Dallas with mythos added.
I was able to get 5 vegetable virgins this month, guys.
Okay. Wow. Can we sound that bell? Do I get to ring the bell? I don't know. You guys keep talking. I just I'm going to sit back and... That's sad.
You're going to have an episode running with subtitles going while we're finishing out?
Shut up.
Chris, was there anything else you wanted to talk about?
Cthulhu Confidential. I'm pretty much doing my last scenario right now, my last scenario 4, and I'm pretty excited about it. I can't go into a lot of details, but when I wrote them, I sort of built them to build on top of each other. So you've got the first one that's in the core book that, light spoilers, I will say, that sort of has Langston encountering a color from out of space and figuring out more or less that the mythos exist. Then you're sort of transitioning into the Taliesin resonator is using as sort of a secret Nazi weapon to the Yithians, which I couldn't resist a chance to actually have, since it's 1-on-1, a character go back in time and do the part of a Yithian, because that's the perfect setting for it.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
And all of that is built up to one of a relatively personal scenario for me, for a lot of the background characters of people that I encountered growing up in Alabama, in a sense.
Oh, wow.
No.
And that's going to be my last one.
So is that 3 adventures for Langston?
There'll be 4 overall. The 4th one, I can't say. Other than that, it's going to be pretty cool.
Okay.
Cool.
So if you haven't played Cthulhu Confidential, you should definitely check it out. It's one player, one GM. It's super easy to run. It's all laid out for you. And all 3 of the characters are amazing.
Awesome. None of us have actually run it or played it, right?
Correct. No. Not yet.
Yeah. You should. I want to, but yeah. Sounds awesome.
Well, Chris Spivey, thank you very much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate you letting me ramble on for a while.
Oh, we love it.
Anytime.
And hopefully be able to see you at Gen Con.
Definitely.
You know, even if it's just a, you know, quick hello and shake hands or a hug, I'd love to just say hi face to face.
I told Chad, but if you're at Gen Con, I always buy the first round, and I can usually be found in the Omni Severn bar.
Oh, cool. Now we've got that on record. Cool.
And we want to hear from our listeners. We have a lot of different ways for everybody to reach out to us.
For a complete list, check out our show notes. That's where you'll find our email address, which is now mup.feedback@gmail.com, as well as the phone number, SpeakPipe link, and our forums.
Send us your questions, your feedback, and your topic ideas, and your pitches for audio segments to put into the show. Or join a discussion, record a line, or tell us who you are, and give us a hearty go pods for our home team, the Fightin' Cephalopods.
Find all the links you need to keep in touch at mu-podcast.com/141.
Thank you for joining us for another episode. Class is dismissed.
The Call of Cthulhu role-playing game is property of Chaosium, Inc. The written works of H.P. Lovecraft are held in the United States public domain. All other works mentioned in this podcast are the property of their respective owners. Original content of this show is copyright of the Miskatonic University Podcast under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike license.
So, okay, so let's make a bumper now. Let's just everybody off the top of your head, whatever bumper you imagine, just have do that now on a count of three. On a count of three. One, two,
sorry.
One, two, three. This is time for riffing. Nobody else did it. That sucks.
Of course not.
Hell no, man. You prompted that too well. We knew you had something in mind.
No, I don't.
That's the bumper now, though, Chad.
I have no idea what to say for such a thing. Well, if I was going to make one, I'd find some nice, catchy jazz tune, because that's where the term riffing comes from, I think.
Oh, I'm interested. That's pretty cool. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's a jazz thing. Do you have an idea, Chris, if that's accurate?
I think so. I can go and know a little bit more about ragtime, because that was more directly linked to Harlem.
Ah, okay. Yeah, I mean, that was the idea that I understood, was that just musicians getting together and then just kind of literally playing off each other's tunes and forming a thing, and that was riffing, and that's where MST3K got the term, and then that's where I've always heard it from. So
it's too bad. I don't know. We can talk to the Coltrane estate and see if we could use that thing that they do in Minecraft with the ghasts going. That's super random. We're moving on now.
No, but Max, you need to cut that little piece out and use that as a. That needs to be a sound bed drop somewhere.
Just combine that with him going, "It's riff time."
I'm thinking the outtakes. Yeah, the outtakes are going to be all Chad.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Riff time.
All right, can we move on now?
Time for riffing.